Abraham Lincoln, Chapter 9, Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. As you will recall, in his inaugural address on March 4, 1861, it was not slavery that President Lincoln emphasized, but the preservation of the Union. This continued to be his chief aim. He believed that upon that great issue he could keep the people of the northern states united. He also knew that in the border states, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, there were many pro-slavery men who were also pro-Union men, and it was a matter of the first importance to prevent these states from joining the ranks of secession. "These all against us," he said, "and the job on our hands is too large for us. We would as well consent to separation at once, including the surrender of the capital." He felt sure that, if he should interfere with slavery within their borders, they would be likely to go out of the Union. But with this cautious policy, all his subordinates did not agree, and two of his generals took matters into their own hands. On August 30, 1861, General Fremont, who had command in the Western Department, declared martial law there, and at the same time stated that the slaves of men who were fighting against the Union were free men. This was going quite beyond his rightful authority, and Lincoln, refusing to approve the order, declared it void. He believed that to take such a step would turn the balance in the wavering border states in favor of secession. In the following May, another commander, General Hunter, declared the slaves free in South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Again, Lincoln refused to approve, and the order was made void. In refusing to sanction the drastic actions of Fremont and Hunter, the president met with bitter criticism from many radical anti-slavery men. They mercilessly censured him. They insisted that he was too cautious, that his policy was lame and halting, that he himself was not a bold and heroic executive, such as the momentous issues of the hour demanded. But Lincoln, though sensitive to such criticisms, did not waver. The plan which he began to lay before the people, before the war had been going on for a year, was gradual emancipation of the slaves, compensation of the owners, and colonization of the Negroes after they had received their freedom. If any state should agree to this plan, Congress was to vote the money to make good to the slave owners the loss of their property. And in the course of a term of years, the slaves in any state agreeing to the plan would be made free. Such a measure, the president believed, would be fair to all. Should the border states fall in with it, they would be putting themselves cordially on the side of the North to preserve the Union. As it was, they were acrimoniously divided, and the majority probably favoring secession, and only sheer military force held them in the Union. This plan was urged upon Congress by Lincoln in a special message early in March 1862, and he made a strong appeal for it to the senators and representatives from the border states especially. But these opposed it so bitterly that the rest of Congress would not take it up. During all these months, although Lincoln hated slavery as strongly as ever, and although he knew it was at the root of the secession trouble, he held to the view set forth in his inaugural address that even Congress had no constitutional right to interfere with slavery in any states where it already existed. And as for himself, no act of his upon it would have had the slightest legal weight, except as a war necessity accepted by Congress. In the meantime, however, the anti-slavery feeling was growing in the North. This fact was made evident by two laws that were passed in 1862. One, enacted in April, provided for the emancipation of slaves in the District of Columbia, with payment of a moderate compensation to the owners. The other, passed in June, was an act to secure the freedom of all persons within the territories. The war was still growing in intensity, and the Union forces, especially in the East, were making but little headway. 4 days after the Battle of Bull Run, General George B. McClellan had been put at the head of all the Union armies under the President, who was Commander-in-Chief. and had been placed in command of the Army of the Potomac, which was intended for the defense of Washington and the capture of Richmond. General McClellan was only 34 years old, but he had had excellent training at West Point and in the Crimean War for his responsible position and had won distinction by a successful campaign in West Virginia. He had the full confidence of the president, who was desirous of cooperating in every possible way. By the opening of the spring campaign in 1862, McClellan had, by thorough organization and drill, created a splendid army. But the people of the North were not satisfied. They had long been impatient for action and were clamoring for McClellan to push on to Richmond. It was not merely to shorten the time of burdens and losses, but because every week's delay convinced the European nations more and more that the North could never conquer the South, and that to save business and civilization alike, they must intervene. Even a year later, just before Gettysburg, a great English writer published a history to come down to the disruption of the United States. President Lincoln himself was quite as impatient as anybody. Although McClellan knew all this, he still held the Union Army in camp. Day after day, the people read in the newspapers, "All is quiet on the Potomac," and they wondered why no move was made. To those who understood just what was going on in Washington, it was clear that the president and the general could not agree as to what should be done. Conference followed conference. Lincoln went to headquarters, and McClellan was called to cabinet meetings. The actual reason why McClellan delayed his advance was twofold. In the first place, he had no faith in his half-trained army's fighting power, feared more Bull Runs, and was resolved not to give battle till sure of success. As was said later, he wished to organize victory. In the second place, he always enormously overestimated the Confederate forces against him and listened too credulously to every frightened or traitorous story of their great armies. Moreover, he believed himself the one capable officer of the country, and not only thought but said and wrote that the salvation of the country depended on him alone. He would take suggestions from nobody, even his military superior. Much more did he assume that those of civilians were simply worthless. "I was obliged to attend a cabinet meeting," he wrote to his wife, "and was bored and annoyed. These are some of the greatest geese in the cabinet I've ever seen, enough to tax the patience of Job." It was not long before he began to show gross disrespect to the president himself. At times he kept Mr. Lincoln waiting in the anteroom of his house while he attended to business matters with others. Lincoln was not slow to observe these discourtesies, but he overlooked the outrageous treatment rather than risk impairing McClellan's zeal or influence by a quarrel. With that utter absence of self-pride and devotion to duty, which were large elements of his greatness and usefulness, he said, "I will hold McClellan's horse if he will only bring us success." Lincoln recommended that an advance be made on Richmond overland from the north in order to keep the Union army between the Confederates and Washington. McClellan objected, knowing that there were many rivers to be crossed, every one of which could, for defensive purposes, be made a Confederate stronghold. At last, Lincoln consented that McClellan might approach Richmond by way of the peninsula between the James and the York rivers, but on the express condition that enough troops should be left behind to prevent the national capital from falling into the hands of the Confederates. In this, he was not interfering in military matters, but taking only necessary political precautions. For the country demanded such protection, and Confederate possession of Washington, even for a week, would have been an excuse for European nations at once to recognize the Confederacy and end the war. No sooner had McClellan gone south than the president's war council induced him to withdraw McDowell's corps of 40,000 men to protect Washington on the ground that McClellan had not kept his agreement. As McClellan relied on this corps to flank the Confederate army in Virginia and leave his march on Richmond unopposed, he regarded this as ruining his campaign and never ceased to declare later that it did so. Having reached Fortress Monroe by water, McClellan started from there early in April 1862 and advanced up the peninsula to Yorktown, to which he laid siege, instead of attempting to capture it by assault at once. This delayed the army an entire month and was needless, for the opposing force was not a third the size of his own. But even after that serious loss of time, it took him nearly 2 months to get within 10 miles of Richmond. He kept constantly protesting that his army was too small for him to do what was expected of him, and that he was not receiving from the administration the proper support. But at last, by the end of May, he was within striking distance of Richmond, waiting for the arrival of McDowell and his army, now promised him once more and marching south from Fredericksburg, not far off. But when one division had reached him, the rest of the corps was ordered back to guard Washington again, for in order to prevent this junction, Stonewall Jackson had swept down the Shenandoah Valley, then called the back door to Washington, and was thought to threaten the city. McClellan was bitterly disappointed, especially since he had halted his advance to wait for the new troops. He was within 5 miles of Richmond and could see its church spires. His forces were still far in excess of the Confederates, who in fact had prepared to evacuate the city. But believing that the Confederate army was twice as large as his own, he let them attack him first. The result was that he had to retreat and change his base of supplies to the James River. In deep depression, he telegraphed during his retreat to Secretary Stanton at Washington, "I know that a few thousand more men would have changed this battle from a defeat to a victory. As it is, the government must not and cannot hold me responsible for the result. I feel too earnestly tonight. I have seen too many dead and wounded comrades to feel otherwise than that the government has not sustained this army. If you do not do so now, the game is lost. If I save this army now, I tell you plainly that I owe no thanks to you or to any persons in Washington. You have done your best to sacrifice this army." "Save your army at all events," Lincoln replied, with remarkable tolerance and self-restraint. "I feel any misfortune to you and your army quite as keenly as you feel it yourself. If you have had a drawn battle or a repulse, it is the price we pay for the enemy not being in Washington. We protected Washington, and the enemy concentrated on you. Had we stripped Washington, he would have been upon us before the troops could have gotten to you." Stanton had less control over his temper. He said, "If we gave McClellan 1,000,000 men, he would sit down in the mud and yell for 2. It is believed by some military critics that there were enough men to protect Washington without McDowell's troops, and that by recalling them, Lincoln prevented McClellan from attaining the great purpose of his campaign, the capture of Richmond. However that may be, the Peninsular campaign failed and caused bitter disappointment in the North. The failure was keenly felt by Lincoln also. In the midst of the gloom and dismay which settled upon the North, he visited McClellan at Harrison's Landing early in July, believing that he could in this way get more accurate information of the actual conditions than was possible from McClellan's letters and reports. When Lincoln clearly saw the true military situation, he made up his mind that some drastic measure should be adopted to strengthen the Union cause. He was now ready to take definite steps toward emancipating the slaves within the Confederate lines as a war measure. It seemed absolutely necessary in order to save the Union. It is said that he finally decided upon the Emancipation Proclamation while on the boat, July 8th, on his return from his visit to McClellan headquarters. 4 days later, he had a conference at the White House with the border state representatives. He earnestly urged them to adopt his policy and accept compensation for their slaves. He reminded them of the hope entertained by states which were in rebellion that their sister slave communities would join the Confederacy. But to his keen and even bitter disappointment, his appeal was made in vain, for the majority of them rejected his plan. Of course, this did not concern his proclamation, which did not affect loyal states or districts, but it would greatly have aided its moral effect, and joined with it would have freed all the slaves, instead of only a part. He had now done his best to secure compensated emancipation, but had failed. There was only one other course for him to consider. He said to a Southerner who had begged him not to issue the proclamation and told him wrongly that he could not legally do it, "What I cannot do, of course I will not do, but it may as well be understood once and for all that I shall not surrender this game leaving any available card unemployed. I have about come to the conclusion," he added, "that I must free the slaves by proclamation, or we ourselves will be subdued." On the day following the conference with the border states' representatives, while driving to the funeral of Secretary Stanton's infant son, Lincoln had a talk with Secretary Seward and Welles about the topic which was making so strong an appeal to him, that is, the emancipation of the slaves. He argued that since the slaves were greatly aiding the Confederate cause, some by producing food to aid the Confederate armies, some by acting as teamsters, and others by doing various forms of labor in Confederate camps, and for other reasons, it would be wise to adopt some measure by which these slaves could help the Union rather than the Confederate cause. After much anxious thought, he called a cabinet meeting on July 22nd. In opening the meeting, he said he was going to communicate something about which he did not wish them to offer any advice, since his decision had already been reached. He said that he intended no disrespect to any member, but that having finally reached a decision, he would stand by it, for he believed it was right. He added that he should be glad to have them offer any suggestions as to details, but nothing more. Then he read, greatly to the surprise probably of all but Seward and Welles, the first rough draft of an Emancipation Proclamation which he had in mind to issue. In this he declared that it to be his intention to recommend that Congress adopt at its next session some plan of emancipation. He again stated the purpose of the war as being the preservation of the Union, and as a fit and necessary military measure for effecting this object, he declared that on January 1, 1863, all slaves in states wherein the constitutional authority of the United States was not recognized should be thenceforward and forever free. After a few slight verbal changes had been made to the proclamation, Seward offered the only important suggestion of the meeting. He urged delay. "I suggest," he said, "that you postpone its issue until you can give it to the country supported by military success, instead of issuing it, as would be the case now, upon the greatest disaster of the war." Then he added his fear that it would be considered the last shriek on the retreat. Lincoln and the cabinet approved this suggestion. Then the meeting adjourned, with the understanding that, for the present, all should strictly keep the secret of the president's purpose, and Lincoln put the proclamation aside to await the Union victory for which he longed. In the meantime, criticism and abuse were heaped upon Lincoln by both slavery and anti-slavery men from all parts of the country. On one occasion, after listening patiently to a group of callers who had come to him with complaints of his failures, Lincoln said to them, "Gentlemen, suppose all the property you were worth were in gold, and you had to put it in the hands of Blondin, the most famous of tightrope walkers, to carry across the Niagara River on a rope. Would you shake the cable, or keep shouting at him, 'Blondin, stand up a little straighter. Blondin, stoop a little more. Go a little faster. Lean a little more to the north. Lean a little more to the south.' No, you would hold your breath, as well as your tongue, and keep your hands off until he was safe over. The government is carrying an enormous weight. Untold treasures are in their hands. They are doing the very best they can. Don't badger them. Keep silence, and we will take you safe across." Among Lincoln's critics were many influential men who were continually urging him to take some definite action in the direction of emancipating the slaves. The bitter abuse by the press reached its culminating point in a signed editorial written by Horace Greeley for the New York Tribune, August 19, 1862, with the heading, "The Prayer of 20 Millions." This was a criticism of Lincoln for his failure to adopt some definite plan of emancipating the slaves. 3 days later, Abraham Lincoln answered this editorial in a public letter which was printed in the columns of the National Intelligencer, a newspaper which was published in Washington. In this letter, Lincoln said, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and it is not to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear to do, I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union." This letter was a singularly shrewd political move. It held back from opposition great numbers who thought the country had no right to abolish slavery, and many more who thought it had no interest in doing so. But beyond this, it was a remarkable state paper. It was remarkable for its clearness, its simplicity, and its strength, as well as for manly courage. It made a deep impression upon the country, and especially upon the plain people, who were strongly in its sympathy with Lincoln. They admired and loved him. They believed that he was honest, and trusted him because they thought they understood him, and they felt that he understood them. There was good reason for this strong bond of good feeling between Lincoln and the people, for during all this administration he was ever ready to take the people into his confidence. If in any part of the country some criticism by factional leaders sprang up as to what he was doing or not doing, it was his habit to appeal to the people by writing such a letter as the one we have just discussed. These letters, brushing aside matters of minor importance, always seized upon the main issue. They were always written in simple, sincere English that the people could understand, and they put arguments into the mouths of Lincoln's admirers and followers, which had a wonderful effect in strengthening public sentiment in his favor. These letters were effective instruments in his masterful leadership. During the whole summer of 1862, Lincoln's critics were severe upon him for his failure to set the slaves free. Their clamor increased, and deputations and committees in great numbers waited upon him. He was censured in the press, in the pulpit, and on the platform. One of the deputations, made up of clergymen from various religious denominations in Chicago, came to him on September 13th and requested that he issue at once a proclamation of universal emancipation. After arguing with them to draw out their full and free expression of opinion, Lincoln replied, "I have not decided against a proclamation of liberty to the slaves, but hold the matter under advisement, and I assure you that the subject is on my mind by day and night more than any other. Whatever shall appear to be God's will, I will do. I trust that the freedom with which I have canvassed your views has not in any respect injured your feelings." When they indicated that he was not carrying out the will of the people, and that the will of the people was also the divine will on this matter of emancipation, he replied, "I hope it will not be irreverent for me to say that if it is probable that God would reveal his will to others on a point so connected with my duty, it might be supposed he would reveal it directly to me. For unless I am more deceived in myself than I often am, it is my earnest desire to know the will of Providence in this matter, and if I can learn what it is, I will do it." Lincoln's power to keep his own counsel is shown by the fact that at the very time when abusive editorials were being published, and when those Chicago clergymen were strongly urging him to emancipate the slaves, the first draft of his Emancipation Proclamation was already written and lying in his desk. but no one knew anything about it except the members of his cabinet who had kept the secret well. Committees and individuals continued to come and discuss the question of the freeing of the slaves with Lincoln, and almost always he argued the matter as if he were opposed to it. In this way, he was balancing the question and weighing the sentiment of the people in order to make sure that he was reaching a right conclusion. And so the summer wore away. It was on September 17th that the victory came for which Lincoln was waiting. On that day, the Battle of Antietam, won by Union forces, drove Lee out of Maryland. 5 days later, Lincoln called together his cabinet. After some general conversation, he took up a book which the humorist Artemus Ward, its author, had just sent to him. From this book, he read two chapters which he thought were very funny. He laughed heartily, but not a member of the cabinet smiled. Throwing his book down, he heaved a long sigh and said, "Gentlemen, why don't you laugh? With the fearful strain that is upon me night and day, if I did not laugh, I should die, and you need this medicine as much as I do." Then, changing to a serious tone of voice, he drew forth from his tall hat a paper and spoke as follows: "The rebel army is now driven out of Maryland, and I am going to fulfill the promise I made to myself and, hesitating, to my Maker. I have gotten you together here to hear what I have written down. I do not wish your advice about the main thing, for that I have determined for myself." Then followed the reading of the Proclamation for Freedom, the pith of which is contained in the following sentence: "On the first day of January in the year of our Lord, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforth, and forever free." The statesmen were silent. The tremendous importance of the words they had heard broke upon them. The man whom they had thought lacking in seriousness sat before them in grim determination, about to send forth an edict that would profoundly affect the destiny of the nation. Then Secretary Stanton said, "Mr. President, if the reading of Artemus Ward is the prelude to such a deed as this, the author should be canonized." And all said, "Amen." In the long and bitter struggle through which Lincoln had passed in reaching a decision to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, he had asked himself many searching questions. Will not the act be that of a dictator? Will it not do more harm than good? Will it not injure the loyal men of the South? According to his own account, he had prayed to the Almighty to save him from the necessity of issuing the proclamation, and, in the language of Gethsemane, he had said, "If it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Even on the day after the fateful step had been taken, he said, "I can only trust in God that I have made no mistake." In spite of the clamor that had been raised in some sections to force such a measure, the announcement of the Emancipation Proclamation, given to the country on September 22nd, was a surprise to the people, and its immediate results were by no means reassuring. Although many newspapers and prominent men commended the Emancipation Proclamation, the country did not accept it with any signs of special satisfaction. The distrust of Lincoln among his critics was as great as ever. Many leading politicians believed the country was moving toward destruction. In 5 great states, among them Lincoln's own state of Illinois, the majorities in the autumn elections went against his party, and the number of men enlisting for service in the army dropped off considerably. The signs of disfavor were so great that many people wondered whether Lincoln would issue the Emancipation Proclamation at the time announced, January 1, 1863. When Congress met early in December 1862, he once more made a strong appeal to that body for his favorite plan of compensated emancipation, to include the states in rebellion also, and so induce them to make peace and remove the great wrong of slavery from the Union. But the appeal was vain. So on December 30th, he called his cabinet together and read the document as he had modified it, asking for their criticisms and suggestions. The next day, at the cabinet meeting, each member handed these in writing to Mr. Lincoln. He took them all to his office and rewrote the document during the afternoon and next morning. Leaving it to be engrossed, he went at 11 o'clock to the New Year's reception, which kept him until about the middle of the afternoon. Then he went back to the office, where he found the Emancipation Proclamation ready, awaiting his signature. Frederick Seward writes, "The broadsheet was spread before him on the cabinet table. Mr. Lincoln dipped his pen in the ink, and then, holding it a moment above the paper, seemed to hesitate. Looking around, he said, 'I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than I do in signing this paper. But I have been shaking hands since 9 o'clock in the morning till my arm is stiff and numb. Now this signature is one that it will be closely examined, and if they find that my hand trembled, they will say he had some compunction. But anyway, it is going to be done.' So saying, he slowly and carefully wrote at the bottom of the proclamation, 'Abraham Lincoln.' A simple act, but one which ultimately struck the shackles from 3 million human beings and undermined an institution almost as old as the human race. It must, of course, be remembered that this measure did not immediately emancipate any slaves whatever. Had it professed to do so, it would have been mere waste paper, for Lincoln had no more power to act contrary to the Constitution than any private citizen. But as commander of the national armies, he had power to take any action needed to weaken the enemy. Hence, the document emancipated not the slaves in the loyal border states, nor even in Confederate districts already conquered, but only in those to be conquered, and when they should be conquered. Its effect was all in the future, and that kept increasing as more and more territory was brought under Union sway. Nearly 1 million slaves were still left to be emancipated by the 13th Amendment after the war, but even those largely owed their freedom to the earlier measure. Even at this time, Lincoln did not feel certain whether the Emancipation Proclamation would bring gain or loss to the Union cause. He thought it would bring gain, and having come to this decision, he was willing to take the risk. We might suppose that his anti-slavery critics would now have given him due credit for his courage, but not so. Even this heroic action seemed, for a time, to divide the North. The extreme abolitionists were angry that it did not wipe out slavery altogether, though it could not. The extreme Democrats, of course, thought it a social and political wrong, while great numbers of moderate people were dismayed because it put an end to their favorite plan of winning back the South by conciliation. As to the South, their fury was unmeasured. The greatest political crime and the greatest political blunder of modern times, one newspaper called it. But there were two other results which amply justified Lincoln. The greatest was a much more favorable attitude in the best countries of Europe toward the North. Its most important effect in this way was definitely to align on the Union side the weight of England, which, as the champion of human freedom, never again seriously considered interfering for the Confederacy. The second was the enlisting of scores of thousands of black men as soldiers in the Union Army. As the North brought under control more and more of the area of secession, the slaves in increasing numbers joined the Union armies and thus greatly strengthened the chances of success for the Union cause. All told, more than 186,000 Negroes took up arms on the side of the Union. This transfer of Negro men from Southern plantations to the armies which were striving to conquer the South had a twofold effect. It weakened the South by reducing the number of men who were working to feed and support the Confederate armies, and by just so much did it add strength to the Union armies. The prejudice in the North against the use of the blacks as soldiers rapidly passed away. These men fought bravely, and in so doing not only helped to save the Union, but also to make it clear that the issue of the Emancipation Proclamation was an act of true statesmanship.